We're at the Hyatt Regency O'Hare, just a few floors above the glamorous Blue Max nightclub.
That's right. More than a few floors. I think it's about a dozen floors up here.
It's high up above.
Yeah, you get a great view. Of course, beside we are now on the 11th floor, but I think you go up a floor or two and they have penthouses or something up on them. And a fantastic view of Chicago from up here in the airport and all that jazz, you know.
The voice you're hearing is that of Maury Amsterdam, our guest this afternoon. And Maury is a Chicago boy.
Well, I got to be honest with you. I was born in Chicago. Mm-hmm. But at the age of two, I packed up my family and moved them to San Francisco. So that's really my home. You know, I went all through school there. And my dad was concert master of the San Francisco Symphony there for 35 years. So I guess it kind of makes me a San Franciscan. But I always used to say, as I'm claimed by two cities, Chicago and San Francisco. Chicago claims I belong to San Francisco, and San Francisco claims I belong to Chicago.
If you moved your family when you were 2 years old, you must have moved into...
Oh, I was a big kid. Are you kidding? I weighed 90 pounds when I was born. Carried my mother home from the hospital.
I see just how this is all going to go now.
Yeah.
When did you first decide that you were old enough to get in the show biz?
Well, actually, when I was 10 years old, I was a boy soprano on radio in San Francisco. That was the early days of radio. And I had a very high voice. At school, they made me sit with the girls, and then when I began to enjoy it, well, my voice changed. So,
how did you get on radio back in those days?
Well, it was experimental in those days, and God, anybody who thought they had any kind of talent would try out, and I think if you could open your mouth and go, you know, you were on. Mm-hmm. So that was how the whole thing started. And it kind of gave me a little feeling for that kind of a business. Although my folks expected me to be a professional musician. I'm a cello player, as you know. Mm-hmm. And all through high school and college, I was never in a school entertainment. I was always a kid who played cello in the orchestra. Then my brother, who was a very fine pianist, went out in vaudeville with one of those big acts, and he was a piano player. And by the time he came back home a year later, why, he was also the straight man for the comic in the act. Mm-hmm. So the comic got sick, and he decided to recruit me. It wasn't my idea. And evidently, I must have had a latent talent for comedy, because I've been in it ever since.
And how old were you at that point?
I was about 14.
14.
And by the time I was 15, I was writing humor, writing acts. When I was about 15 and a half, I was writing for a fellow named Will Rogers. I think you may have heard of him.
We know him. Yeah.
And Fanny Bryce, Frank Morgan, Robert Benchley. Through the years, I've written for just about every top comic in the world.
You mentioned Frank Morgan and Fanny Bryce. Were you involved in writing for their... They had a radio show.
That was the show. It was called The Good News Show. Mm-hmm. And the master of ceremonies, the first one was Robert Taylor. See, we used all MGM stars in those days. And it was under the auspices of MGM, although I think the show was sponsored by Maxwell Coffee. And then we also had Robert Young was our MC for quite some time, Meredith Wilson's Orchestra, and every big-name MGM star in those days was on the show.
One of the biggest shows of those days.
That was
middle to late 30s, wasn't it?
That's where we started Baby Snooks on that show. And it was 1937. You're right, 1937, 38, and 39, and I was a writer on the show, and one of my co-writers was a fellow named Ed Gardner, who later did Duffy's Tavern. And we wrote for just about every big name, people like Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Melvin Douglas, just all the big names at MGM, Myrna Loy in those days.
What did it take to be a radio writer? How did you write for a variety show like that? What did you?
Well, I think you had to start out with a little talent. That helped. Mm-hmm. And like I wrote comedy spots for Fanny Bryce and Frank Morgan. Now, here are two different comedians on the same show. So that was my first real feeling that material had to be tailored. Mm-hmm. In other words, the same kind of jokes and lines that Fanny Bryce would do were not the same kind of things I wrote for Frank Morgan. And I became kind of a, I guess you'd call, in-the-skull mimic. As I sat at a typewriter, I would mentally do these people. That's what gave me their timing. And that's how I would write for them, and I've written that way ever since.
You wrote for... what did you write for Will Rogers?
Well, I'll tell you how that started. I was a cello player in the orchestra at Lowe's State Theater in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I was only 15 years old, but I played cello, I played saxophone and clarinet. I was also the comedian with the orchestra, the singer with the orchestra. And Will came in as a special guest for 2 weeks. And at that time, they paid him $25,000 for the 2 weeks, which was considered fantastic. It was an unheard-of amount of money, which he turned over to the community chest, a charity. And he had the dressing room right next door to mine. And I would pass by there once in a while. He'd be sitting at his typewriter, and he saw me doing comedy in the show, so he'd call me in and he'd say, "Hey, kid, what do you think of this?" I was kind of like a sounding board for him. And I said, "Gee, that's great, Mr. Rogers. I like that. Maybe it would be funnier if you said this about so-and-so." And he said, "You know, you have a very good talent for this." He says, "Sit here with me." And I started first, as I say, as kind of a sounding board, and pretty soon I was writing lines for him, many of which, well, I don't know if you pick up a book in the library or any good bookstore on Will Rogers, and many of the things that he said and were quoted to him were written by me as a kid in those days.
That's amazing.
And we became very, very good friends, and I would never leave my cello in the theater because I was afraid it might be stolen, and who had money for insurance in those days? So he'd call me the kid with the doghouse. He'd say, "Come on, kid, get the doghouse, let's go home." And he would drive me home every night and pick me up in the morning on the way to the theater. Another thing, he loved cowboy movies. So between shows, he'd say, "Hey, kid, come on, let's go. There's a George O'Brien picture across the street." And we'd go, and he used to make comments that were absolutely hysterical about the different cowboy stars and so forth. And I learned the value of good timing from him. I also learned the value of good taste. I once said to him, "Will, how do you get away with talking about all these famous people all over the world?" And he said, "Well," he said, "about 90% of it's the truth." And he says, "A wonderful thing about the truth is you don't have to remember it." And he said, "The other thing is you notice no matter what I say about anybody, I always wind up saying something good about them so they can't get mad." Write any of the things that he did on stage or his monologues, but I wrote a picture called Bedtime Story with a man named Richard Flournoy. And Robert Benchley was on the show, on the picture. And I started writing things for him in the picture, and he got a kick out of it. And then I started giving him jokes and things for him to do in the character that he did. And he was a one of a kind. He really was a fine artist. And a fine writer,
amazing,
of course, in his own right.
Yeah. That's what was curious to me, that he was such a fine writer. Well, he had a writer, too.
You must understand that somewhere along the line, you take a guy like Bob Hope. Mm-hmm. People say, "Oh, my gosh, he's got 10, 15 writers." But Bob is not only a great editor for himself and a great ad-libber. Bob is fabulous. Mm-hmm. But he also knows, as I said, as an editor, he knows what's good for him, which is a marvelous talent. Like four or five guys can submit material to him, and he says, "I'll do this, I won't do that, I'll do that." And it isn't because he's just being choosy or because he thinks that's funny or the other thing is funny. He does it because he knows what's funny for him, and that's an art within itself.
It's amazing with so much, we hear so much about Jack Benny and his talent as a comedian, and Benny always talked about the writers, his writers were everything, but on the other hand, the writers always said Jack was a great editor.
That's right.
That's what you're saying about Bob.
You would pick up an old Jack Benny script and you'd say, "What's funny about this?" Well, what was funny about it was the way Jack did it, his timing, his feel for it. And he would never dissipate that. I remember I once wrote a love scene for Jack to do with Fanny Bryce. He was a guest on our show. And we would always read it a few days ahead of time. We'd have the guests over and we'd go in a private rehearsal hall. And I read this scene and I never heard anybody laugh so much. He laughed. He says, "Gosh," he says, "that's the funniest sketch I ever heard." He says, "I wish I could do it." Well, he said, "I wish I could do it. You know, for me, a young writer, that was like dropping a bomb." I said, "I don't understand, Mr. Benny." "Well," he says, "you got me doing the jokes." He says, "I don't do jokes." He says, "I'm the man who gets the butt of the joke." I said, "But this is different." I says, "You're a guest on our program." He said, "Well, the difference is that," he says, "I can't dissipate 18 years of having built a character on radio for one guest appearance." And he sat with me till like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning rewriting this sketch. But it was a Jack Benny sketch when we finished with it. And he was a fantastic guy. Later, I did a lot of concerts with Jack, you know, raising money for symphonies. Mm-hmm. And he was always, he was so knowledgeable about comedy. It was an education to sit with him and watch anything that was going on in a comedy vein.
You worked with him on the stage?
Yes.
Jack Benny on the violin and Maury Amsterdam on the cello.
Yeah, we also did a great show for Kraft. We did the Waukegan Music Hall, the Waukegan String Quartet. That was Jack, Henny Youngman, myself, and a wonderful violinist who passed away too soon named Michael Rabin. And I have it on videotape at home, and it's absolutely hilarious. It's a great, great comedy sketch.
You were involved in a couple of radio shows in front of the microphones, too. I think I read someplace that you were involved with the Al Pierce show, Al Pierce
and his
Pierce
gang. Al Pierce and his gang. I was with Al Pierce 5 years. And as well as being a comedian on the show, I did a lot of writing for the show. Not only for radio, but for personal appearances. Because he had no idea how much money could be made in personal appearances. So, and then we talked about it, and he said, well, all these people are radio people. They don't even know how to walk on an office stage. I said, I'll teach them. And I did, including Al himself, who had no idea of how to walk on a stage and without turning his back on the audience and little niceties that you must keep in mind when you're performing.
He was purely a radio personality.
He was purely a radio personality. He and his brother Cal, who still lives in Laguna Beach, California, were a couple of guys who finally got a hold of a record show one night, and they played the banjo and they sang, and finally out of it evolved the Al Pierce gang. And I was lucky enough to be part of it. That was great experience for me. 5 years with them on the road doing radio.
Pineapple from Hawaii.
That's right.
Dole Pineapple.
Well, yeah, we had so many sponsors. We had Swift. We had Armor. We had a load of them. And, of course, the charm of radio in those days was the fact that when you had a sponsor and you were identified with the product, they could easily, it was much better than a Nielsen rating. Because all you had to do was ask the sponsor, are you selling more or less of your product? And if he was selling more of the product, he knew what was responsible for it.
Well, that's true. That identification was perfected in radio.
Radio,
unlike television, as you well know, you can go for 10 years with a single sponsor.
Whereas TV,
if they go 10 weeks, they consider themselves.
Well, Arthur Godfrey was a great champion of that. Lipton soups, and Arthur had such a great sincerity about him. Not only on radio, but he carried it into television. If he said, this Lipton soup is really something, you believed him because he didn't betray the trust of his audience, and he would tell them. He'd say, look, he said, if I didn't like this stuff, I said, I'm not going to eat it or drink it under any circumstances. He said, we use it at home, and I thought it'd be good for you to try it anyway, you know. And it was that simple simplicity which is lost in television today. Instead, they go into all kinds of extensive, either humorous or serious. And people say the same things, but if they said in your living room, you'd throw them out the window. You know.
Well, television today, they don't integrate the commercials into the program anymore.
No, Jack Benny, if you remember, with Jell-O.
Sure.
My gosh, you thought of Jell-O, you thought of Jack Benny, or you thought of Jack, you thought of Jell-O. And I think that was marvelous for the sponsors. There are comparatively few shows on television today that have one sponsor.
There was on radio a Maury Amsterdam show.
Several.
What was the Maury Amsterdam show on radio?
After I left Al Pierce's gang, I started a show on NBC called The Maury Amsterdam Show. Lasted for a couple of years. Then we went over to Mutual, and we did a show called The Laughing Swing Club. And that lasted for about 3 or 4 years. And about that time, I went back to California, and I was doing radio, nightclubs, theaters, and so forth. And I got involved in television. As a matter of fact, in Los Angeles, KHJ was the first franchise television station in the world. In 1939, we started doing experimental television. And that's when I started with them. Of course, in those days, we had to wear a completely white makeup, black lips, black in the nostrils. Everybody looked like Marcel Marceau. And you couldn't stay under those lights for any more than 10 minutes because they were absolutely unbearable. And out of that evolved what we have today, and the fantastic pictures. I look at them. I see the satellite pickups from various parts of the world, and it's unbelievable. Well, radio, television, telephone is still a big mystery to me. I think it's unbelievable the stuff we have today.
How did you get involved with the Dick Van Dyke Show on television?
Well, through Rose Marie. I was in New York doing my own television show, a local show with Milton DeLug. Later, of course, we did Broadway Open House, which was the first of the late nighttime shows.
Well, you were the very first host of Broadway Open House.
That's right.
Was Jerry, that Blatt's? Was that Blatt's beer?
No, that was Anchor Hocking Glass.
Oh, that's
And in
right.
every city, the beer company that used Anchor Hocking Glass for their bottles were the local sponsor.
Oh, I see.
And as a network, it wasn't really a network of stations as far as transmitting the show.
Mm-hmm.
What they saw in the rest of the country were kinescopes, which were films of the show that we did in New York.
And very fuzzy. Very,
some of them were good and most of them were bad. And I've got a gang of those. And even before that, I did a show called The Maury Amsterdam Show, in which I started Art Carney and Jacqueline Suzanne on that show.
Jacqueline Suzanne?
Yeah, she was a cigarette girl on my show, and Art Carney was a waiter. Called The Maury Amsterdam Show, it was subtitled The First the Golden Goose Cafe, and then the Silver Swan Cafe.
But is that where Yakka Puck started?
No, it started in radio.
It did?
When I did a radio show in New York called Gloom Dodgers. Well, I'll tell you about that. I have the world's record for radio shows. I did 75 shows in 1 week.
In a single week?
In a single week. I'll tell you about that in a minute. But I want to tell you about the television show. It was Broadway Open House. But before Broadway Open House, as I said, I did the Silver Swan Cafe. It was on the Dumont Network, which is no longer in existence. And Art Carney, whom I had taken from radio, I was doing a situation comedy show on radio for CBS called The Maury Amsterdam Show. And when we moved to television, I took them all with me because Jackie Suzanne was a cigarette girl and Art Carney was the doorman, Oscar the doorman. And it was called the Golden Goose Cafe. We moved it to television, including Jackie's husband, Irving Mansfield, whom had never been in television, and we moved him in as my producer, too. I insisted on it. And then we had some problems with CBS, so we moved over to Dumont. They said, you can't use those characters on the show. You'll have to change them. So instead of Silver Swan, it became, Golden Goose, rather, became Silver Swan. Instead of Oscar the doorman, he became Newton the waiter. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it went all the way through.
Wasn't he using that vroom
yes,
thing at that time?
That's right. I started that. That's all part of the material I wrote for the show. And Art, incidentally, that was his first comedy show. More than that, it was the first time he had done comedy because he was a mimic with the old Horace Hite show on the road. And then he became a dramatic actor, and he was doing heavies on a show called Gangbusters, which I'm sure you've talked about.
Sure.
And when he came to me and he read the script thinking he was going to read a dramatic part, he auditioned for it. And I was sitting in a darkened theater with Irving Mansfield. I said, this guy is funny. He'd make a great waiter or doorman for us. So Mansfield said to me, well, I don't know. This isn't television. This is radio. I said, what do we got to lose? Let's hire him for a couple of weeks. If he's no good, we can always get somebody else. Well, he turned out to be Art Carney, and he's the guy is just great and a marvelous sense of humor and a funny, funny man and a very nice guy. I've been lucky in our business. I've worked with nothing but nice people, and it's always been a happy association, like the Dick Van Dyke Show. It was a happy wedding of the nicest bunch of people you ever met in your life, in front of the cameras and in back of the cameras, and equally as talented. And I think that was the success of the show.
Did you have much to do with any of the writing on the Van Dyke Show?
Oh, I did a great deal of the writing. Mm-hmm. Carl Reiner, of course, instituted the show. Carl had 17 scripts written before we did the first one.
He did.
Yeah. Now, you asked me a question, which I didn't complete. You asked me how I happened to get the Van Dyke Show.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, I was working on a local station in New York, and Rose Marie, Dick Van Dyke, John Rich, who was the director, Danny Thomas, and Sheldon Leonard, who owned the show, were sitting around talking, and they had it entirely cast except for the part of Buddy Sorrell. And Carl is sitting there. He says, we got to get a guy who's a gag writer, who's a comedian, who's been in show business a long time. And Rose Marie, whom I've known since she's 12 years old, and I've written everything she's ever done in front of an audience, said, how about Maury Amsterdam? And Carl smacked his head. He said, my gosh, he said, I've known him. He was the last guy I thought of. He's absolutely perfect. Picked up the phone and called me, and I was in Yonkers, New York, digging my car out of the snow. And he said, Maury, we're sitting here casting a show. He said, you want to come out and do the Dick Van Dyke Show with us? Next morning, I was on the plane, and that was it.
It was an absolutely sensational program, and you and Rose Marie were really the highlights of it, I think.
Well,
the
I
comedy,
think...
The comedy, the lines, and it, without Mel...
Mel Cooley,
Richard Deacon, it would have been...
Well, we created a relationship on that had instant comedy hit. When he would walk into a room, and if I stood up and looked at him, the people would laugh because they knew it was coming. And he's a fine performer. I'm going to tell you something about Richard Deacon that you probably don't know and is good for your memorabilia. You ever look at some of the old Boris Karloff movies?
Occasionally,
the
yes.
Frankenstein and those. Next time, look a little closer, and you'll find that the skinny, cadaverous-looking butler is Richard Deacon.
Really?
Yep, that's the guy. You'd never know it today. He's big as a house, you know.
Yeah.
But and he was pretty heavy on the Van Dyke Show. But there he was, that skinny little bald-headed guy whom I think he probably was bald from the time he was born and never got any hair in his life. But that became a wonderful relationship. And to this day, of course, we're all very good and close friends.
It's still running. It's going all over the country, all over the world,
all over the world. We are, our reruns are in 48 different countries. I've seen myself in 7 different languages in different parts of the world. And it's a classic. It's something that always holds up, and it was funny then, and it's just as funny now.
You did 5 seasons of that.
Yeah, 5 years. We did 165 shows. Mm-hmm. I also own and produce a show called Can You Top This?
Yes.
Which we made 195 shows so far, 195 half hours, and plays all over the world.
Now, aren't you a part of that?
I'm also in the show, but
yeah.
It's my show. It belongs to me.
Well,
that was a big radio show, you know.
Of course, yeah.
For 14 years. Yeah. But it had never been done on television, and I bought the rights to it and put it on TV.
That's sensational. Well, what else? You have a reputation as being a fastest man with a gag.
Yeah, it's a
Weren't you involved in a show one time on the air with where they were trying to stump you, give you a subject? And,
no, that happened on almost every show I go on.
Everything you do.
Because I have a reputation for telling a joke about any name, subject, or article in the world. And it's gotten to be, it's a little like being the fastest draw in the West. People don't even say hello. They challenge you constantly. It gets a little tiresome, but I always come up with
something.
Can
I challenge you once?
I don't care. Everybody else does.
Radio.
Radio is wonderful. How else can you get at so many people that can't get at you?
All right. Okay. You had a story. We digressed a moment or so. You were going to tell about all the radio shows you were doing. You did 75 shows in
that 1 week. Mm-hmm. It wasn't only radio shows. You know, I had been on radio and had a pretty good nationwide reputation, and television was in its early days. And you're always looking for some kind of a gimmick to make you a household word. And I thought to myself, what can I do? I'm going to do more shows than anybody has ever done. And I owned a nightclub in New York at the time, and I was on radio and television and playing theaters. So here's the way it worked. In the morning, I was on from 9 to 10 and 11 to 12 on a show called Gloom Dodgers, which was a pure variety show with an orchestra. Mm-hmm. And I introduced people who are all big names now. A couple of them are playing in town here, Vic Damone and Jack Carter and so forth. Mm-hmm. I started them all on that show. And then at 1:30 to 3:30, I did a record show. Then at 7:30 to 8, I did another live show. Beside that, I was doing 2 shows on television a week on a show called Stop Me If You've Heard This One, mm-hmm, on NBC. I was doing 2 shows a night in my nightclub and 5 shows a day at the Strand Theater. And at the end of the week, we totaled them up, and there were 75 shows, and I was completely exhausted. And now 1 week of that was enough. But I made it, and I think I'm somewhere in the book, Guinness Book of Records.
Are you
for
with that?
I must be, yeah.
You have really been entertaining people for your whole life, then, from
said 10 years old. That's right. I have been in just about every branch of show business. I'm a professional musician. I write songs. Mm-hmm. I write books. I write scripts, and I appear in nightclubs, theaters, television, radio, and so forth.
One of your big songs was a big hit in World War II.
It was probably the biggest hit in the history of music business, Rum and Coca-Cola. Why Did I Ever Leave Wyoming was a big cowboy hit. Can't Get Off My Horse. I did the theme of the Dick Van Dyke Show. A lot of songs for Pearl Bailey, Stan Kenton, Frankie Lane.
And you said you wrote Rosemary's Act?
Her nightclub act from even before that, her stage show. Mm-hmm. Before, when she was, I think she was about 12 years old when I first met her. She's my daughter's godmother.
Uh-huh.
Like one of the family, Rosie, you know.
Needless to say, you wrote your nightclub act, too.
I wrote everybody's club act, I think. Yeah, I write constantly, you know. You can become, after a while, kind of an observer on the current scene, and you write about whatever is going on in the world.
You like writing best of all?
No. I think if you like your business, you like all facets of it. Mm-hmm. I always say that I'm like the guy in Finian's Rainbow who says, when I'm not near the girl I love the girl I'm near. Mm-hmm. Whatever I'm doing at the moment, I like the best.
Well, at the moment, you're starring at the Blue Max.
That's right, and having a wonderful time.
You're doing a great job there, too.
Good audiences, and the people have been very kind, and I'm having a ball. I really am. I enjoy it. As we travel all over the world. My wife's always with me wherever we go, and she's out shopping now. Oh, no, she went to the antique show across the street here.
Oh, that's
the Expo.
Right.
Because my wife happens to be a very successful interior decorator and designer. So she went over there and got anything like that. She'd rather spend an afternoon looking at houses or fabrics or furniture than go to a ball game or a horse race or anything else or play golf. And she's a member of ASID, of course, and a very talented lady. She did all of the offices at Radio City, does aeroplanes, boats, everything else. But in the past few years, since we moved back to California, I just wanted to kind of take it easy and just enjoy herself. Mm-hmm. So that's what she does. She doesn't do much work.
Now, you are involved in a new TV series coming up in the second season of this next
year. Yeah, but it's a show called Mixed Nuts. It's a follow-up on Cuckoo's Nest, a comedy follow-up. And we did the pilot, and the pilot was on the air and grabbed all the ratings from all three networks. And everybody was so happy with it, we had a starting date in January. But now we're getting a little flack from the Department of Mental Health and the Psychiatrists Associations and so forth, who seem to think that we're making fun of people who are having mental problems. But we're not really, not at all. It's just good, down-to-earth fun. So meanwhile, we can't start on the date we were tried to, but ABC is fighting them, and we'll wait and see what happens.
So somewhere along the line, we'll be able to open up that can of mixed nuts.
I hope so. And meanwhile, they offered me the part of Ed Asner's boss in his new series, and I had to turn it down because, I knew I was under contract ABC for this new show, so that went by the boards. But they told me, don't worry about it. If you don't do one or the other, well, we'll have another show for you.
Oh, great. Well, there's always good entertainment when Maury Amsterdam is on.
Somebody asked me last night about how I pick the things I do, and that is, I try to do the things that I would laugh at if I saw somebody else do them. And I never do anything dirty on the stage. I just think doing dirty material is like putting on dirty clothes. It's unnecessary. We've had great comics throughout the years who never said a dirty word on the stage and were funny and good. I remember when I was a kid starting in vaudeville, I used to have signs in the dressing rooms. Anyone caught using the words damn or hell will be canceled immediately. Did you know that?
No.
They didn't care how big a star you were. They'd throw you out of the theater if you used those words. But today, gosh, they say and do everything. And I think it's kind of taken the fun out of it. I really, really do. It's like teaching little kids, giving them sex education. To me, that's wrong. I call those people the dream destroyers. It's like telling them there's no Santa Claus. Give them a little chance to grow up anyway. At least wait till they're 9, 10 years old, and then explain it in a sensible way. But to take little kids 4 or 5 years, in the first place, they're not interested. They really aren't, and why shove it down their throats? Yeah. It just isn't right. People forget that we had generation after generation throughout the years where people lived happily, and everything came along normally, and people did the things that were the right things to do. Well, you know, one of the reasons I think that your late-night movies and television are so popular, pictures, my gosh, that were made 20, 30, 40 years ago, the kids all want to stay up and watch them. Because there's something to watch. It's fun. It's entertainment rather than just a lot of violence or sex on the screen. And I think it's entirely unnecessary. It's taking the charm and the fun out of it. That's the way I feel about it.
Well, I think that you'll find a lot of people would agree with you.
Yeah.
And we thank you very much, Maury Amsterdam, for spending some time to reminisce a little bit today.
I told you about my new book.
Oh, the book, right.
Can't forget that. My new book I wrote a cookbook for drunks. It's called Betty Cooker's Crockbook. And it's actually about 300 great recipes, all made with liquor as part of them. And the teetotalers don't have to worry because the alcohol burns off, just the flavor is there. And you'll find that good gourmet cooks all over the world all use wines and beers and Cointreaux, those kind of things in cooking. And the funny part is I don't cook and I don't drink. I never drank in my life. As a matter of fact, Johnny Carson once said to me, "How could you write a book about booze you don't drink?" I said, "I know a lot of guys manufacture brassieres, never wore one." But the truth of the matter is, in between, I've got about 150 drunk jokes, and the recipes are very, very good. I've got them from good gourmet chefs all over the world. Matter of fact, we were at Danny Thomas's house for dinner the other night, and Rosemary, his wife, later said to us, "Did you like the dinner?" I said, "It was just great." She said, "Those were your recipes."
Oh, really?
Yeah. But the book is a fun book, and you'll find it in any of your bookstores. If you can't remember the whole title, just say, hey, have you got Maury Amstram's cookbook around? And that'll do it.
Well, let's get the title again.
It's Maury Amstram's Cookbook for Drinkers, or Betty Cooker's Crockbook.
Betty Cooker's Crockbook.
Yeah.
Thanks, Maury. Thank you very much. Yeah.